I got your chair. I don't
call this meeting order. All right, members, what we're doing today is Representative Bradley will walk through the... this is an informational hearing. Representative Bradley will be available for clarifying questions, and it's just a chance for us to all better understand the Delete Everything House File 1422. So with that, Representative Bradley, you're on the spot.
Thank you for putting it that way, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and members, in your packets you should have information which I hope will be helpful in understanding the decisions that I'm bringing to you today. You should have a copy again of something that we shared with all committee members. I think it's called, it's a single page Health Finance Committee 2005 Budget Worksheet Governor's Recommendations. That sort of reminds us in fairly simple kinds of forms of what the governor's budget was from current law. You also have a summary sheet, which I will use primarily as my presentation. It's a sheet that has copied on front and back. It's called the Health Committee Omnibus House File 1422, and when we move the bill on Thursday, that'll be our base bill, is House File 1422, and there will be, you have in your packet the delete all. That's the other thing that you have, is a delete all with all of the articles that we will be considering and reviewing today, and then acting on Thursday, and taking public testimony tomorrow. And then you also should have a fiscal spreadsheet, the landscape form that looks like this. I'm not intending to really go through that as much. All these things are sort of a backup. I'll try to do my very, very best, and I hope members recognize I always try to do this to make people aware of what I think are the most important relevant pieces of information in the bill. So I'll be doing that. I want to start, if I may, however, Mr. Chair and members, we may disagree on policy things. We may disagree even on priorities at times in this committee, and that's okay. That's what this deliberative process is about. But I know there's one thing that we do agree upon, and having seen it firsthand in this last week and this weekend and last night, I want to personally extend my thank you to both the partisan and nonpartisan staff who have carried the ball while some of us were doing all kinds of things. But over the past several days, through this heavy weekend, and into last night, I was here a little late myself and a little early this morning, and I can tell you that they're all working hard. And so to our fiscal staff, to our research staff, to the revisor staff, to our pages, and even to the hardworking people that do all the duplicating work and all the kind of administrative work. And I hope I haven't missed anything, but I have, just sort of in general, to all the staff really that make this place hum and pay the enormous price when we come to these sort of crunch times, and this is what it was like. So thank you very much to all of them on behalf of our committee. Now, with that, Mr. Chair, I begin with just a bit of a reminder of sort of where we were. The budget itself is a budget and general fund that is in the range of a little over $7 billion. The forecast would have been for our area about an 18% increase. The governor proposed a budget that still increases, reduced that rate of increase to 15% for the next biennium. You all, I think, know when we passed our targets, the House passed an additional $50 million that we added to our targets above and beyond the governor's expenditure. And then we have, if you will, sort of what was called the Plan B, which is another $20 million depending upon the passage of a different kind of bill. All those are integrated. I will review those with the committee in detail. If I may take a somewhat of a diversion, we have a lot of language in here that does affect budget, and actually these items affect the budget, and I'll be going through them for the budget numbers. But there are a couple of really important issues. I know they were very important, especially to Representative Tremba, to Representative Lanning. In part was the lien on life estates. And you will see in this bill a repeal of retroactivity of the lien on life estates. It cost us a pretty penny, and it cost us over $13 million to do that. And that's the financial side of it. The other thing that was done was a pretty significant change. There was some controversy to the governor's proposal on trusts and annuities. And the proposal that is countering that or replacing it now in the bill that will be before you and we will discuss takes on a completely different approach. Actually, I think it's more consistent with the bar that made recommendations that you really don't need to do it the way it's done, that you can actually use essentially a current law and you can move that decision up at the eligibility time. Now, I'm giving you the short. I have asked, and Commissioner Goodenough has been kind enough to come because I think these are so important. I want members to feel very confident in the actions we've taken, not just in the financial part of it, but also in the policy side of it, not to be debated really, but just to make sure that members clearly understand this. This was negotiated at the highest levels to make very sure that we satisfied members' concerns. So, Mr. Chair, if we might, I would like to call the Commissioner forward to make further comment on these items.
Welcome to the committee. Commissioner, how's your baseball team?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, better than yours.
Please proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you. I wanted, Representative Bradley asked me to come up and just speak briefly about two provisions that are included in this bill. And I'd like to do that at this point. First of all, he mentioned the whole issue of buying back the retroactivity of the estate recovery for life estates and joint tenancy interests. And I know that's an issue that Representative Vertrembo has mentioned to me a number of times, as well as Representative Lanning. And what we did was work with at Representative Bradley's insistence and also Representative Vertrembo's insistence and Representative Lanning's insistence on language that would buy back that retroactivity. So what I'd like to do is just briefly, in your bill, just point out the sections within the bill that do that. So you can highlight those, and if you have any questions, you can certainly ask them of me now or save them for another time, and we can try to also address them at that point. But if you look at page 59 of the bill, which is Article 3, Section 39, there's a provision, there's about a couple pages of dialogue there. That's just basically stating that the provision applies for interests that are entered into after August 1st, 2003. There's a like change in the date on page 100, Article 3, Section 79. And you have to go through quite a bit of wording, but at the very end of that section, there's also a discussion about the applicability of estates and joint tenancy interests established after August 1st, 2003. The next point in the bill where it's addressed is Article 3, Section 86, which is on page 106. And this is language that specifically defines when an establishment of a life estate or joint tenancy interest was established. This is just to add specificity, so there's no question about the applicability. And this was taken straight out of, I believe, Representative Lanning's bill from last year. And also subdivision 2 under that is just the definition for medical assistance is needed to make certain that it applies both to medical assistance recoveries as well as alternative care recoveries. The next item that I want to point out is page 107. The next page is Article 3, Section 87. This just deals with in a situation where the way the money would be distributed would be it would be distributed to the record holder of the interest at the time of the death of the life estate. If it's a life estate interest, would be at the death of the life estate holder. The people that own the remainder interest at that time, the money would be distributed to them based on their ownership in the property at that time. If they're unidentified, if we can't find it would go to their estate and be distributed based on the estate of those individuals if they passed away. If we can't locate those individuals, we'll make effort to do that, but if we can't locate them, then it goes into the unclaimed assets fund of Commerce, and it will be dealt with through that mechanism. I think in most of these cases, since there are, this is relatively recent, that it should be relatively easy to find most of these individuals for refund. And we are refunding under this. It would be 100% refund, both the federal and the state match. And that we as an agency, then, if this were to pass, we'd have to go back to the federal government and ask for reimbursement, which we may or may not be able to get from them. So that's another argument that would come up. Then finally, under Article 3, Section 88, page 108, is a provision that just holds us harmless for implementing the law as it was passed 2 years ago from any personal lawsuits or anything like that. Just trying to cut back on the lawsuits out there. So the net effect of all these changes and all those provisions that we spoke of would be that the recovery of life estates and joint tenancy interests for people who are on MA would only apply to those interests that were established after August 1st of 2003 when the original law was passed. And so for people that have established a life estate after that point or joint tenancy after that point, this would still apply to them. But for people that were caught in that retroactivity of the law, they would be held harmless under this provision and under this bill. And just a note, I'll draw your attention, it's on spreadsheet line 356. And I believe the current year biennium buyback on that is about $13 million. Now, on the other issue that has been making its way through the legislature this year, it dealt with the issue of annuities and trusts. And that is found in Article 3, Section 78, which is on pages 98 to 100 in this bill. And we dropped, under this bill, it drops the initial proposal that came from the governor's office. And what's inserted in here under pages 98 to 100 is compromise language that we have been working on with the probate and trust section of the bar. In their testimony to you, in their written testimony to you, as well as their oral testimony, they've stated that they had some alternatives that they wanted to work with DHS on. These are the alternatives that we have worked on. There may be, at this point, I know the insurance industry has signed off on it, is okay with the language. The bankers, I think, are in committee right now discussing to see if they're okay with it. We haven't heard any initial complaints. The Bar Association, my understanding was at one point they were neutral on it, but they haven't given me anything definitive on it. But at this point, we think we have an agreement on this compromise language. This results in, basically the change here is to try to get through all the legalese. It deals with irrevocable inter vivos trusts, which basically are trusts that are established during the lifetime of the person that established the trust. And what we say is that if that person applies for medical assistance, that the either the income or the assets in that trust that's established with the assets of the recipient would be, we would include it in their assets when we're calculating their eligibility for medical assistance. So we're dealing with it on the front end as people are entering the system rather than dealing with it on the back end after they're in the system. So it's an eligibility issue on the front end. If you have assets available to you, or if you have assets that were set up in an irrevocable trust that you as an individual set up or your spouse set up, that will be accessible to you, to us in determining your eligibility for the program. And that's the impact of that provision. And the spreadsheet line on that one is line 268 in the spreadsheet. And there's a decent savings related to that also. Representative Bradley, a good point. That is prospective. So it's for trusts, irrevocable trusts that are established after the effective date of this provision, which is July 1st, 2005. So again, we're not doing any retroactivity here at all. So for people, it would be for people establishing irrevocable trusts after that date. And just as a note, on section... there's a small letter D in parens. It deals with that it does not apply to certain trusts. The trusts it does not apply to are supplemental needs trusts and special needs trusts. Those are trusts that are established for people with disabilities, and those trusts are not impacted by this change at all.
Representative Goodman. Or, excuse me, Representative Goodman.
Yeah, I was confused as we look so much alike. Mr. Chair and Commissioner Goodnow, does this then eliminate all the annuities that were in the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, the whole issue of annuities are dropped from this.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
And Commissioner Goodnow, could you explain exactly how this would work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, yes. Basically, when you come in and apply, you list your assets that you have available to you in order to determine your eligibility for medical assistance. In the past, if you had an irrevocable trust that had been set up, that would not be something you would list as available assets. Under this law, if there's a trust established after July 1st of 2005 and you apply for medical assistance for nursing, long-term care medical assistance, you would have to list those assets as available to you on your application for medical assistance. So it doesn't involve going to the annuity company or the insurance company and trying to get them to send notice out. It doesn't involve going to the bank and having them, you know, work on this. It just involves the individual recipient when they're coming in and applying for medical assistance.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, give me some examples of what would be in those trusts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, typically there's two different types of trusts that are established typically by a grant by an individual during their lifetime. One is a revocable trust. Those are the ones that are most commonly used because people that are still allowed general control over their assets. Those assets that are in revocable trusts we already have access to and are listed as assets. Irrevocable trusts are trusts that they can't revoke, that you can't eliminate it as a grantor. There's usually provisions within the trust document that allow the trustee of the document of the trust to dispose of the trust at some point if there's some certain conditions are met. But it's used quite often as estate planning purposes for tax, to avoid estate taxes. With irrevocable trusts, arguably under the laws that we've had in the books, you won't be able to access those assets. So you could put any type of asset in an irrevocable trust, just as you could put any type of asset into a revocable trust. And so it could be cash, it could be the proceeds from a life insurance policy, it could be land, it could be any type of asset that you would typically place in a trust or that you could own as an individual, could also be owned as a trust and placed in a trust. So it's that wide open.
Any further questions on this topic for the Commissioner? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Bradley. Good luck with the baseball thing.
I need it.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, it's not my intention to go through the governor's budget summary sheet that I gave you that I mentioned previously. I have that just sort of as a backdrop. I think what's really important to, and people are sort of waiting to hear and discuss, is what we have done as a delta to that. So if members will draw it out and, you know, I forgive me for not, and if you want to refer to the more formal spreadsheet, I have gone through that as well, but I think you'll find it easier to have the decision points stand out if we refer to the 8.5 by 11 sheet that's titled Health Committee Omnibus, House File 1422, Fiscal Summary of Bills/Ideas for Changes to Governor's Budget, etc. And I would bring to your attention, if we can take that side, on the side that has begins its first item, or the top says House File 22, Base Document Plus, Additional Investments. And I will walk through with the members. The first side is a set of investments that are recommended to this committee as ways to really do prioritization. What these amount to, I think, in listening carefully to members of this committee, to the public, I think that what I heard was that in order of priorities of the people that we serve through the funds that we have fiscal responsibility, our first and foremost are persons with disabilities. Second and close right into that are frail elderly who need our help. Third are children. Fourth are parents and families, and then fifth would be able-bodied adults without children. That's sort of the order that I think. And there is, as you will find in here, a reflection of that kind of prioritization in philosophy where we put our money. So let me begin with, on the first item, if you recall, the governor had proposed to reduce the reimbursements for pharmacies from the current AWP minus 11.5% to AWP minus 14. This proposal line buys that back to 12%, so it makes a $7 million investment in the next biennium in order to be able to do that. The next item is the positive alternatives. The only thing we reflected here, because in the governor's budget was the $2.5 million for the first biennium and then $5 million the next. This is just some of the preparatory work that has to be done. The next item is the abortion notification data reporting, and there is some work that would need to be done in that, and that's the $136,000 that you see in the 06-07 biennium. I left them on because it makes it a little bit handy just to have in front of us, even though there's no actual cost, just as a reminder of some of the other bills that have been accommodated in this omnibus delete-all. And one of those is the Family Planning Grants Limited. Another one is the unborn child pain prevention, and that language is in the omnibus bill, even though there's, as I indicate here, there is not a fiscal impact. The next really important decision item is one that I think from a policy point of view, this committee has been unanimous in agreeing that the 20% shift that we've placed on counties for ICFMRs is really not productive, as one would probably even say in many cases causes things to happen that are really not in the best interest of Minnesotans. We weren't able to find enough money to buy all of that shift back, but we did buy it from the current 20% down to 5%. And the amount to do that is, well, there's an interaction amount, so it's roughly $15 million to take that action in this budget. The next one that I know has been in, amongst many, many of our constituents has been trying to do something, and we had, I think, really great testimony here when I presented the parental fee modifications bill, House File 619. We have in this bill the full implementation of House File 619. And that amounts to $2.6 million of expenditures in the next biennium. We just discussed the life estate recovery, and I won't go back through that again, but the House File 2019, which is pretty much the Maury Landing bill, repeals a retroactivity, and the cost for us is $13.3 million in the next biennium. Another area that I know we've all heard a lot about have been the whole spectrum of long-term care, continuing care people who, except for the governor's proposal to do a 10-1-0-5, 2% increase in rate, were devoid of any increases in the governor's budget. This was a focus amongst many, many people who talked to me saying we have to deliver something here. We're going to see a lot of these places unable to continue their services. They're stretching. The employees deserve a chance at increases. So, and I'll try to take you through kind of a somewhat complicated set of transactions, but the first transaction on the first line of that says long-term care provider rate increase, 2+2. What that would mean is we would do a 2% increase on 10-1-05, and then another 2% increase on top of that on 10-1-06. In part, I think the dates are a way to kind of try to manage the budget. And the other thing that we're doing, just to fulfill disclosure in the next line, it's called additional COLA increase. You'll see on the other side, we took what I think are some fairly aggressive, sometimes easy and sometimes hard reforms. At least the iteration that we completed gave us some additional money, because I know, frankly, a lot of us wanted to try to get as close as we could to the 3% that was in House File 775. At this point, there's an additional $11.8 million that we would apply in kind of a general way as an addition. And I can't tell you exactly, but my guess would be that that would probably bring us up to the 2.2, 2.3 or so range. It's a way of using sort of the additional revenues that we've raised with the reform actions that we'll review on the back. Now, as a part of doing this, we also had a nursing home study, so we've just included that in here. This is sort of looking at the rate restructuring, those kinds of things in nursing homes. And then we had some pretty complex interactions that, frankly, I'm still trying to sort through myself. When the governor did the 2% increase in 10-1-05, there was also the beginning of the implementation of a new rate restructuring in the 06-07 timeframe, most of that into the 07 actually. And in doing that, there were a certain number of factors from that new system that actually kicked in. And the governor's budget actually included some additional money, so it was actually a little bit more than 2% in the next year. Well, it gets kind of messy, but the fact of the matter is this committee's only got so many dollars. So what I told DHS was, in the next biennium, I want to treat nursing homes equally and fairly as we treat the other groups, group homes, ICFMRs, so manage that next biennium within the 2% extra bump that we make in the second year of the biennium. It seemed to be fair to do. Well, it turns out that gets kind of complicated, so that's why you see some sort of cancellations here. And I think that's what those are, is for the cancellations of things that were in the original governor's budget. The net effect, however, is still that nursing homes as an industry will get the same 2-2 as is done in the other areas like group homes and ICFMRs. That's that. Again, there's a few items that I've included because they were tracking as I wasn't sure if there were going to be monies, but the shaking infants danger education that Representative Pepin had is included. The expenses are actually part of special revenues. The removal of the sunset on the anti-hemophilic factor is included here and included in the bill. The inclusion of Representative Pelosi's bill on PACE is included in the bill, even though there's no money. We did also pick up the MA swing, but I think this was Representative Prentice's bill, I believe, if I remember right, that this was a small investment. But that bill is actually included then in the bill. The House File 1360, which is my bill, which, if you recall, was an expansion of the current system to some additional counties and regions in the state. That's what the $150,000 is. Again, on the House File 1491, which is the postpartum depression, although there's no money, I just wanted to acknowledge for the committee that that language is included in the bill. We did another thing, in House File 1574, which was Representative Samuelson's bill, I believe. If you recall, that bill had sort of specific raises in the home care industry's rates because, as was shown, we are far below all the states in our immediate region in our rates. We couldn't, frankly, afford to go that far. What we did do is put in addition to the 2-2 that those groups would get, this is kind of an additional 5%. Now, it'll at least move them, it accelerates the movement of their rates along, and it does spend $1.2 million to do that additional acceleration. Again, we didn't spend any additional money on the rural pharmacy. I think we did some carve-out things. I believe this was Representative Finstead's bill, but just again to acknowledge to you that we did include that language. House File 2172 is a bill which promotes through the Department of Human Services a broadening of the application of the Region 10 Quality Assurance concept to other programs across the state, so it asks the department to come back with recommendations to do that. And that spends $102,000 in the next biennium. The long-term care partnership, although it doesn't spend money, I think this committee was very supportive of Representative Abler's bill, and that bill is included as well in the omnibus bill. Representative Wilkin had House File 980. I think to the credit of Representative Wilkin, and particularly to the credit of the advocates in that community, did a lot of work to bring this down into a range that we could afford. I think the original forms, Representative Wilkin would admit maybe we're a little bit rich for what we could afford, but we've taken some really good actions. We've contained it within the $877,000 in the current biennium and actually realized some savings in the next biennium by incorporating that bill as well in its modified form in the omnibus bill. I'm sorry.
Just to bring me back, House File 980, that was the big omnibus disabilities bill that had, and do you remember what the fiscal note on that was originally?
Representative Wilkin.
100 type, 100 million type range?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Thank you. I was just anxious to see Representative Wilkin create a new impression for himself. They never quite got there. So. I'm serious about the advocates of Representative Wilkin worked together extremely well to bring forth a good package. A House File 1967, which is Representative Powell's bill, I think is another example of a pretty complicated, very controversial issue, as a matter of fact, and I think a lot of you got mail on this. I'll at least give you kind of the framework of the agreement that Representative Paul and people had sort of reached. I'm not sure that everybody is completely satisfied, but I think that this is as good a kind of a compromise as I can see. One, it delays the implementation of the brokering for nursing homes across the state by 1 year. Two, it establishes, and in kind of management sense, I sort of call this kind of the short lease thing, to put in place a kind of an interim tracking committee that will week by week, month by month, be tracking the progress. We all saw some of the results historically that the call return times were horrible, but we saw indications that in the last weeks that it was getting better. And there were a lot more people being applied. It looks like it's there almost, but so that it doesn't get away on us, we'll keep a very short lease on it. And I think those are kind of the primary result. I'm sorry, there's one additional item. There is a rate increase to certain kind of special transportation where it would be basically stretcher-based people. The reason it's revenue neutral is that if it weren't for that, frankly, we'd be having an expensive ambulance carry. So we can do that revenue neutral. So, President Powell, thank you for some really great work. We included, I think this was Representative Broad's bill. I want to say $500,000, but it's all coming out of the lottery fund, so we don't need to track it in general fund here, but I just wanted you all again to realize that we are including that bill in our omnibus bill. Representative Abel's proposal on children's health, the youth special kids, and if he hasn't promoted you, I'm surprised, because I think he's talked to me 15 times about this proposal. But it is a great idea. This is taking kids who have very expensive, very difficult medical conditions and giving them better care and saving lots of money. Frankly, I think this has great potential for the future, and you can see it nets a modest savings in the current biennium. The next one is the residency requirements information that Representative Seifert had before us, and you can see that the work on that required $55,000 of investment in the current biennium. Representative Abel also had House File 120.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry.
If I could, could you refresh me on House File 932, the detail of that a little bit more? Residency requirement for what?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, let me, the best I can, because it did evolve from its original form. In essence, what Representative Seifert was looking for was a better sense of where people were when they came and applied for our benefits. So it was a sort of a prior residency, where were you? The language is a little bit complicated, and I think we narrowed that a bit. And what we discovered in the meantime was that I think for those programs that are in the Jobs Committee, they already producing a report, they already have the information. For the programs that are in the health area, there was some work needing to be done to get some of that information. But essentially it was, when you apply for medical assistance, that we would be able to track and indicate where what was your prior address.
Thank you.
Representative Goodman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, where is that in the bill? I just remember that being laid over and we didn't discuss it and we thought that that wasn't necessary at all.
Representative Bradley.
I don't know the page. Can staff point it to us?
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, it is in Article 6, Section 2.
Article 6, Section 2.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, yes, I believe it starts on page 211 of the bill.
Hey, Mr. Chair, looking at that, it's actually been narrowed even more than I thought, because it now speaks only to tracking those who were not Minnesota residents prior when they apply.
Representative Goodwin.
But And Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, don't they have to track them to find out if they were Minnesota residents?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, they would. And in most of the applications, we actually do have their prior addresses. And I think that's why there's a slight investment here for those, for kind of filling in the gaps of places where we didn't have that track.
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Would there be someone from the agency, or would that be appropriate that just to explain a little bit more what the process they go through on this one would be, what's involved in that?
Is someone from the department here that...
From the department, yes, yeah. Sorry.
Agency, department, anybody that wants to talk about this? I see no volunteers here, so...
Okay, well, if...
Oh, there's someone's coming.
We do have somebody.
Thank you. I can do this on the side, too. We don't have to do this in this forum, either. It's up to you.
Well, now that you're here, you've came down, let's... Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kathy Henry from the Department of Human Services. This will be very brief because I can't answer your questions directly, but I'd be more than happy to meet with you following the committee hearing and we could walk through.
That would be great. Thank you.
All right. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on, the next item, House File 127, I believe is Representative Abler's project, and that was the idea of having a repository for being able to potentially recycle some cancer drugs. And I think what we've done is we've conceded that we're going to use general fund money. The Board of Pharmacy basically said we're not going to be able to continue this if you ask us to take it out of our funds. So it's a modest investment. Hopefully this in the future will actually yield us something. So that's coming out of general funds, and that's in the order of $50,000. The next five items, members, are sort of a tough decision. We had many, many, I think upwards of nearly 30 proposals for rate exceptions in nursing homes and other places. And I finally decided that about the only fair thing to do, it's very hard to make exceptions except for some really exceptional conditions, and I will review one exception to the general rule. The first five exceptions are fairly easy because they don't spend money. I mean, it's as simple as that. These are proposals that shifted the completion dates or did those kinds of things and either spend no money or have a little bit of savings, actually. So you can see the five projects there. The exception to that standard, and I'll explain my logic, is the Stearns, Benton, Multi-County. And in fact, this committee passed that last year. I think in some respects the committee thought it would actually go into effect somehow. It turned out that the language wasn't quite right to be able to do that. So the precedent I've used is that since we've had sort of a double hit here, I believe this area is one of the last metropolitan statistical areas that actually is metro that is not in the metro region. However, I didn't think that we needed necessarily to draw all these counties up into the median of the metro area. That's why the recommendation is about $2 million rather than the nearly $4 million that was in the original proposal. I think this will draw them up probably from a metro rate somewhere maybe into the first quartile. And I think that at least from my own opinion, that the situation is unusual enough that making an exception for that particular group makes sense. And then the final investment, if you will, is that donated dental service. And I will admit to the committee, this is something that we did not actually hear. It was something that came to my attention, actually, just in the last couple of days. It was in a bill that had some other items in it, and that's probably why it didn't quite come to our attention. But it strikes me, though, that with a very small investment of $120,000, we can leverage considerable amount of volunteer work from the dental community, and that's what this bill does. So that's why it's been included. So, Mr. Chair and members, that concludes the items of investments. Now, if we can turn the sheet over, I'll walk through sort of how we gather together in reforms, savings, sometimes very easy, sometimes very hard. I won't kid you, there are some hard decisions in here, but I think even the hard decisions, I've tried to have these done with the priorities that I mentioned at the outset in mind. So let me walk you through, starting at the top. The first one is an item that Commissioner Goodno mentioned. It turned out, even with prospective application on the trust, that we actually managed to get some savings in the next biennium by the application of that. So that yields us about $4 million. We did discuss previously the sex change, the circumcision, and you can see that we did book those items, and those are the savings that were projected, the $30,000 in one case and $625,000 savings for the biennium in the next case. Although it doesn't save, I just wanted you to know that the language that we had reviewed with the committee on seeking a waiver to allow us to apply premiums on income and our medical assistance, especially since we're moving so many people from Minnesota Care to MA, is booked there just to show you that the language is being included. That's in power with a considerable amount of work in trying to tighten our language as far as the proper use of emergency rooms, and in that yielded about $3.3 million worth of savings for the next biennium. Representative Pepin carried a proposal which I think is a fair, this probably does not actually keep up with the rate of inflation of the cost of our Minnesota care, but I think is a fair level of increase. It would increase the minimum, which is currently $4 per month, to $5. That's the first line that you see. And this is for people that are below 150% of federal poverty level. And then anybody above that, it's a fairly straightforward, simple 10% increase on their premiums. House File 979 is the pharmaceutical medication therapy management. I know many of us believe, frankly, I think we ought to be able to get more savings in that. But it's important, I think, enough for us, even though the savings are relatively modest, of only $96,000 in the next biennium, that we included that in the bill. House File 2394 is a collection of reforms that Representative Emmer had. We are still working it through. We put in a conservative number of $1 million savings a year. I think we should be able to achieve that, but we're still working through sort of the pluses and minuses because there are some interactions that were still complicated, but to have at least a placeholder, a conservative placeholder, we show that yielding us $2 million in savings in the next biennium. The next item, members, is one that would be new, I admit, to the committee, and this one sort of was intriguing as we began to sort of really do zero-based budgeting, some of us. We were looking at alternative care, and I'm a big believer in some respects in alternative care. Now, we have to understand that alternative care is different than elderly waiver. Elderly waiver, we get full federal match on the dollars. And in many respects, there are people in alternative care that probably could be getting federal match. But what we found is that alternative care is supposed to be, the criteria is supposed to be that the person in front of you that's eligible for alternative care, one of the major factors is that they are at risk of being in a nursing home within the next 180 days, 6 months. Well, it turns out in actual practice that the averages are more like 10 months, which says we're probably being a little bit generous on the front end. By setting the eligibility to 120 days, which I think frankly might bring us a little bit closer to that original objective, and I think it's not unreasonable policy, we made $14.5 million of savings. So it seems to me this is kind of a reform where it's a good news. That is that this, I think, brings us more in line with where we probably ought to be with the intentions in that original program, and also saves us a fair amount of money. The next item, on pay only for medically necessary, this is some work that Mr. Powell did, but it turned out that with the interaction with the governors, the governor had a number of elements on sort of improving our handling of our public assistance care, and those things pretty much canceled each other, so there's no additional savings, but we did retain the language, so we will find the language in the bill. And then on prior authorization, we will find language to Representative Avery's credit. I think we worked this thing until we found that we could get some credit for it. You'll see in the bill some actual specific areas like imaging kinds of expenses that are maybe sort of a leading edge and are very suspect these days and maybe being overutilized, that we would require prior authorization. And that would yield us $1.8 million in the next biennium. The next item is one of those tougher decisions. I think, again, it comes back to sort of the priorities. In looking at a
Mr. Chair, if I
represent,
I'm sorry. On that prior authorization. Do you know where that is? In, any idea where that is in the bill?
Can staff?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Thiessen, that language is in Article 3, Section 36.
Thank you.
And if you look over and have some questions when we get done, I'd be happy to discuss it further. But yep. On the next one, I want to be very honest with people. So first of all, just to remind ourselves, in the reorganization of benefits, eligibility, and so forth, one of the pluses that was placed was on GAMC reinstating the spend down. Now, that's a great advantage to hospitals, to the probably the person that's being taken care of. It's not as much because they're probably going to be taken care of regardless, and it's a question whether it's going to fall into uncompensated care or compensated care. A tweet that was suggested to me that, well, you can see it saves us $7 million, was instead of having that spend down go to the 75th percent of federal poverty level, which is the standard eligibility for GAMC, we don't change eligibility with this. What we change is the level of spend down. So the level of spend down would instead go to 50% of poverty. And for most incidences of a population that is extremely low income, sporadic part-time work, probably some chronic conditions that bring them episodically back into needing health care, generally that spend down wouldn't make a difference. But it did manage to save us an additional $7 million by doing it. I don't want to kid anybody. It's one of those tougher decisions, but I think it's one of those that has a modest impact. The next item is...
Excuse me, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, how many people is that going to affect? The GAMC spend down to 50%. I mean, who's going to pay the $7 million that we're saving there?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, this one, and Representative Huntley, it's a little hard, and I don't know that I saw in any of our fiscal activities any estimate of the number of people, because we're talking about a phenomenon where these people are still all eligible for GAMC. The question is, how many times do you bump into a difference in the spend down, and that's the net. I guess what I have to assume is that in these cases where that $7 million is a savings, is likely that the hospital would have to absorb it. And that's a little bit tricky, but that's as good as I could do. Would be since that person still remains eligible, but is not able to spend down in whatever the circumstances may be, and now how thinly that spread, I mean, that could be spread fairly thinly and have a minimal impact across hospitals, but I don't have a good feel by hospitals at all.
Well, I'm just, our current spend down at 75% is just went up to the dollar amounts like $590 a month. So this is going to be considerably, they have to spend down to, they've only got $400 a month left.
Representative Bradley.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, those numbers are probably right. I don't remember exactly, but that's probably right. But remember, this is an episode where the low-income people that we're talking about have a fairly significant cost. This, is, again, doesn't change their eligibility. But I'm not trying to hide behind anything. Today is just a matter of understanding, and if people have alternative ideas, when we come back together Thursday, I'd welcome them. But we were looking for those kinds of things that we could take action so that we could do the priority investments on the other side of this page.
Well, Mr. Chair, that then means help me. That Kathleen Christine would have to spend down below. She was under the old law. She was $40 above her mortgage payment. Now she'll be won't even be able to make her mortgage payment.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, could you describe in a little detail how that debt spend down works?
Representative Bradley.
Well, maybe it might be better if I had either someone from the department that could come down, and I want to make sure that I do it right. I mean, I have an idea of what it works, but let's make sure if you're asking the question that we get the specifics.
Ms. Henry, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy Henry from the Department of Human Services. Just generally speaking, spend downs If you imagine an income standard of $500 a month, and a person has a monthly income of $600, the spend down is the difference between their monthly income and the income standard. So they would have a $100 spend down. They're obligated to pay the first $100 of their medical bills. That's what the spend down is. It's like a deductible. And then the balance of their medical bills are paid by GAMC, your medical assistance. Our general assistance medical care does not have monthly budget periods, so you apply that philosophy or that theory to a six-month period would be the difference with GAMC.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need a little more clarification. So if my income is $500 a month and I need a 50% spend down, that means that I'd have to pay the first $250 of my income towards any medical bills that I had before I would be eligible for GEA.
Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, the spend downs aren't drawn in percentages. In the example you're giving me, it would be a $750 a month income applied or compared to a $500 income standard. So in that case, you'd have a $250 spend down for a given month. And again, I need to clarify that this is for medical assistance when we're talking monthly. In the case of GAMC, it would be that $250 times six for a six-month period of time. I would be very happy to sit down and walk through some examples with you. It is very complicated.
That's a good one.
Mr. Chair, but I think we need to know that now, and I think the public needs to know it, too, so that we know what we're voting on here. So I am trying to understand now, what kind of a spend-down do we have right now? We're going to 50% spend-down. So tell me how that would work with a typical a person that's on general assistance medical care.
That's Tim Bradley.
Sure, just to be clear, today there is no spend-down in GAMC. The opportunity for spend down is in current law is not there. So the governor proposed to make the spend down to the 75% of income. This would make it 50% instead, but today there is no spend down.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bradley, I still need to understand exactly what their income would be in a month and how this would affect their medical bills, and I don't understand yet what's happening here.
I think Ms. Henry did answer that and gave you the numbers, and you could do a little bit of math on it. But if you look at the numbers I heard, there's going to be a difference between the person's income, because we can't sit here necessarily, between their income and the spend down level. Whatever that is, and if they were making, I think you were using 700 and something a month, and if the spend down was at 500, that means there's 250 times in 6 months. If you went into the hospital, you had a huge incident that occurred, $100,000 bill, GAMC is going to pay for that $100,000 bill less the amount of that 6 month spend down. That's it, right? Do I have that right?
So what would that amount be, Mr. Chair?
Well, 250 times 6 months, whatever that is.
1,500.
All right. Representative Bradley.
Thank you.
I want to ask that.
Oh, Representative Goodwin.
I'm trying to figure this out still yet, Mr. Representative Bradley. So would that mean they could only make $400 a month and be... or have $400 a month left of their income? How does that work?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I think you know that it's a little more complicated than that. The hospitals have the right to bill for that difference. Whether or not those people have the capacity to pay, and this is why I said before, I was sort of admitting most likely not. They may, and they may very well have a bill that they pay over a length of time and so forth. So nothing says what their income can be. That's not what it is. This is just establishing the floor where the spend down will kick in. So what it amounts to is establishing when will the taxpayer pay the expenses. Above a certain amount, the taxpayer will pay all of the expenses.
Representative Goodwin.
Okay, Mr. Chair, then what you're saying is that the person would only have $400 a month left to pay for their rent and their utilities and their food and those types of things.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, no, I didn't say that.
Okay. Any further comments, Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Bradley didn't say that, but that's the fact that if someone's earning $1,000 a month, and we go to the 50%, that's roughly $400 a month. So they would have to spend the first $600 of their medical bills for that month, and they would be left with $400 for to live on.
Representative Bradley.
Well, Mr. Chair, today was supposed to be an understanding. If we understand it, we probably should move on. I would just remind people that current law, there is no spend down. So, in fact, the taxpayer, by virtue of these changes, is taking on an additional liability that we don't have. And this is all part of the governor's attempt to provide at least a fair safety net. Not as good, maybe, as it was before, but at least a fair safety net. But admittedly, this is a reduction, and we show that from where the governor's proposal was. Okay.
All right, moving on, Representative Bradley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the next item is a delay in timing of the discount card, and the one below that is a reduction, I was wrong, I think, in putting delay. It actually turns out to be a reduction in the board and region grants. The next line item is an item which I believe interacts with a waiver that's going on. I don't see Representative Wilkin here, but by eliminating the family planning grants, this would happen with a waiver implementation, so the money would come in through, I believe, on medical assistance. The next item, in looking again at priorities, one of the questions that was raised was, in the time when we have needs for group homes and ICFMRs and home health care, should we be going out doing promotions, advertising programs? So we made somewhat difficult decision, but to eliminate the $1.5 million that we currently spend in outreach, advertising, marketing. The next item is an item. Actually, we passed this item previously. I'm sorry.
I had a question on that. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, eliminate family planning grants with waiver. Can you go in a little bit more detail? I'm not sure what that means.
Unfortunately, Representative Wilkin was... is there somebody here that can?
No.
Representative Wilkin is up here, so maybe he'll...
The family planning grants...
Representative Otremba, if you could just repeat the question for Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin, on the spreadsheet it talks about eliminate family planning grants with waiver implement. Can you give me a little brief synopsis of what that actually means and what actually that we're eliminating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, the legislature several years ago, and I forget what exact year it was, agreed to approve a waiver request to the federal government that the department wanted to do for family planning under MA to, I think it's 200% of poverty and below, people would be eligible for that specific benefit. And that's going to go into effect, I think it's now, last I heard was July 1, 2006, which would be in the 2007 biennium. So once that takes effect, there's really no need for the family planning grants. So we're going to get rid of those and use that money elsewhere in the budget, and we'll have it'll be on a fee for service or through the other method through MA.
Complete. So, Chair, to be clear, then this only affects medical assistance participants.
The waiver,
Representative Wilkins.
Right.
I believe that's true because it's an MA waiver.
Okay, and so then if they
the federal government,
okay.
Representative Wilkins.
So then if they make more than a certain dollar amount a month, they pay, you said, a fee, or is it that they don't qualify at all? Or do they have to pay a fee for under 200%?
Representative Wilkins.
Maybe Mr. Chun could help them in that area. Specifics.
Mr. Chun. This is the waiver
that I believe the plan is to go into effect when Health Match is implemented, and it's targeted to people either who are exiting one of the state health care programs, you know, MA, Minnesota Care, or GMC, or people who are not enrolled in those programs. There's an income limit of 200% of poverty, and you need to be between ages of 15 and I think it's 55, 15 and 50. I'm not sure whether or not there's a fee charge for these services, and these individuals are eligible for most of the services that would have been, or most of the family planning services that would have been available under the state health care programs.
Representative Chairman.
Mr. Chung, can you tell me where that is in the bill?
Mr. Chung. Or someone.
Mr. Chair, it's on page 305 of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Trimber asked half of my question. My second half of my question is the disparity grants. Where is that in the bill?
Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that is just a repealer. It would be about the last section of Article 3, and it's just repealing the grants.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chung, I just needed to do a correction. While Representative Bradley, your priorities is your priorities, to eliminate outreach to address disparities is not solely advertising and things of that nature, specifically doing treatment and testing, and goes much more around advertising. It's really doing the work that it was set out to do. And again, while your priorities is your priorities, I think it's best to set for the record that it's not advertising dollars that we're utilizing these programs for.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the correction, and I'll stand corrected.
Representative Huntley. Okay, Representative Bradley, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on, as I was trying to say about the next item, which is called Eliminate MA Eligibility for Undocumented Pregnant Women with Federal Insurance, we had actually passed that. That was in our House bill last year. And all it does is just say that they should not be eligible if they have alternative insurance available to them. The next item also was in last year's bill, and this is sort of a catch-up in our general philosophy of co-pays. Somehow we had missed MinCare in our co-pays, so that item is to catch up. That was previously passed too. As you can see, that would save us $900,000 in the next biennium.
Representative Bradley, one second. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley, I think both of those two areas need further explanation. Both the MA eligibility for undocumented pregnant women and also the MinCare eligibility verification. I see that's $922,000, and the other one is $1.2 million. Could you take a little time with those two, please? Tell us a little more about that.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I wasn't here last year, Ms. Representative Bradley, so I don't know you talked about in your bill last year.
Well, let me explain again, but what it simply amounts to is that a undocumented pregnant woman who has other insurance would not be eligible for MA, and that's been kind of a standing policy, so it's straightforward as that.
Representative Goodwin.
So, Mr. Chair, if they have other insurance, they wouldn't ordinarily be eligible for MA unless they didn't have any maternity benefits in the other plans. So you're saying even if they don't have maternity benefits in another plan, they are not eligible for maternity benefits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's any place at this point with either the self-insured plan, because ERISA calls requires maternity benefits, and in our current fully insured mandates, we have a requirement for maternity benefits. So in current law, there would be no circumstance that you're describing.
Okay.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, I think that needs further examination, but let's go to the Minnesota Care Eligibility Verification. What is that in a little more detail?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I mean a little help from staff to see. I know that one of the things that applied was a $3 copay and I don't remember what the AAV, I think $6 was for emergency room copay, so I believe all it was doing was applying what we had originally intended were copays in the Minnesota Care, but if there's anything else besides that, I'm not so sure about the eligibility verification part. Okay, then maybe we can come back.
We'll come back to that. Representative Huntley has a question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, back to the MA, undocumented pregnant women with other insurance, as you said, is there some difference? What if U.S. citizen had other insurance? Would they be eligible for MA if they have other insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, if a U.S. citizen had other insurance, I mean, they would, of course, need to meet the MA, you know, asset and income standards and other requirements, but MA will sometimes pay for insurance premiums for persons who have sort of cost-effective third-party coverage if they think that if the department determines it's cost-effective for the MA program.
Now, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, maybe you can follow up later, but I'm just very surprised that there's over $1 million in savings per year from this particular item.
I just go by the fiscal notes. Sometimes I argue.
Mr. Chair, maybe somebody from the department could explain why that $1 million in savings is there.
We have someone from the department that can comment on this. Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I probably can't answer this question entirely either. I can tell you that the difference with the undocumented pregnant women is due to SCHIP funding. There was a law passed a few years ago that would provide prenatal care coverage for undocumented pregnant women using SCHIP funds, and it was a violation of the SCHIP requirements for us to provide coverage to insured undocumented pregnant women. So it's a little different than medical assistance. As far as the fiscal note goes, I'm assuming it's that number of undocumented pregnant women who we are known to have insurance.
Ms. Shilkins, can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, members of committee, according to the fiscal note, and I can provide this for anyone who is interested, the department estimates 2.5% of the overall average monthly enrollees to be covered by other insurance. In the first year, they anticipate 86 people to have other insurance, therefore they would be ineligible. And the cost of that is just shy of $250,000. And in the second year, they anticipate 93 to have other coverage. And because there is a phase-in, then in the first year, you don't get a full cost impact, but in the second year, in 07, you do get a full cost impact, and it's about $900,000 in cost savings.
Let's see. The list is getting longer. Representative Huntley?
Yeah, I'm just having a hard time understanding how someone that's undocumented, obviously if they have insurance, they're working, or their spouse is working, probably illegally. I'm just amazed.
All right, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the department can explain to me how it determines its projection of who currently is receiving and what will be changed in the next year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I am not qualified to get into that level of detail, but we certainly can provide that for you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful not only as it relates to this particular line item, but in general. We're talking about moving folks to GAMC. We're talking about not just the proposed eligibility, but what the department has said it will be. Their numbers will be shifting. I think we need to know how they determine that.
All right. Representative Otremba, then Representative Goodwin. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question for House Research. When they referred me to page 305, I really couldn't tell, because there's a lot of repealers and statutes and things, which one it was that was referring to.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba. It starts on section 62, paragraph B, on page 305, and then if you turn the page to page 306, you'll see the effective date, which refers to the waiver there. It's the actual repeal of section 145.925, which is the family planning statute.
Okay, thank you. And my second question is, Mr. Chair, is, and I've had this discussion before with undocumented immigrants, and what they count as, are they counting prenatal care? Because the minute that baby's born, it's an American citizen, and so then it has to be covered because it's an American citizen. So that's where my numbers... that's where I'd like to know if the numbers are being counted for all of that or part of it, because most of us in this room believe in an unborn baby is an unborn baby, and therefore it probably is an American citizen in utero, but for sure it is upon birth. And so I'd like to know what those numbers are.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that I'm entirely tracking to that. I think if you recall back a couple of years ago, our original proposal was to discontinue coverage for all undocumented immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
We had considerable discussion about pregnant women, prenatal care, and so we restored that, mm-hmm. and that means that covers everything. I think the standard MA has extensions beyond for postpartum care as well. So, I mean, what that means through this S-CHIP money, because we ended up using S-CHIP as a way to get there, and I think that's the reason for this language. When that was adopted, we didn't have any exclusion in there about alternative insurance. So we're sort of trying to fix that with this. I guess all I can say is George Hoffman is generally pretty good about making estimates, and he's the one that says that 2.5%. I mean, that's his number. I had nothing to do with the number.
All right, I think we're all informed. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. To that point, Mr. Chair, I think we need those people to be here to testify, because we are going to have a lot of questions about the numbers and about the number of people that are losing health care. And it's not satisfactory for us not to know the numbers and how they were arrived at and how many people are affected. That's just not good public policy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would also comment, we are all able, I think, to do some homework ourselves, and Michelle just referred to, generally all these things, all the assumptions and everything are documented pretty thoroughly in the assumptions in it. We went through the budget pages as well on this. We had considerable discussion about the governor's budget, so, I mean, these things we have had. Now, if necessary, if that doesn't satisfy, we need further discussion here, we'll certainly do that. And so we'll need to see for Thursday if an item is brought up that needs discussion. We'll just need to be sure, and I think maybe we'll need to be sure that Mr. Hoffman is here for Thursday's discussion.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Bradley. As long as we're having the discussion of MA eligibility for undocumented pregnant women with other insurance, I'm wondering if we could also maybe track down the number on the amount that we're paying currently for undocumented workers who don't have other health insurance, what the cost is to the state of that, because we're not even addressing that issue here. And I think that's a discussion we should have at some point, and I would just be curious as to what that number is.
The department just assured me that we don't have it right now, but we'd be happy to follow up and get that, because we should be able to carve that out. We know what that S-CHIP exception was, so just don't have it right now.
All right, moving on.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe action for the next biennium, there's only one remaining item, and this one is another one in terms of priorities. If you recall, the governor's proposal, in addition to the changes made in GAMC, eliminated eligibility for able-bodied adults without children, and then also lowered the eligibility for parents to 190%. This proposal would lower that 190% to 175%, and it would yield us $8 million in savings. And then the next line is the fairly straightforward targets.
All right, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, how many additional, we heard with the governor's proposal that 22,500 people would lose health coverage. How many additional people would this affect?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, the governor's proposal, to give you a specific, because I just finally got this and I anticipated that question would be asked, and it's a fair question. The governor's proposal talked about 6,500 eligibles that would be affected by the lowering to 190. Lowering to 175 changes that to 9,200, so we're talking about probably about 2,700.
Oh. That's some good one.
Oh. Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, I see you've got 8.2 million booked for the cuts to Minnesota Care, and then up above you have another 2 million booked for Minnesota Care eligibility reform. So is it 10.2 million for the biennium, or is there more in other places here that affect the Minnesota Care eligibility?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, this is a good one. Certainly not trying to keep any secrets. All the things are in front of you. If you want to speak to the things about Minnesota Care, there is a premium rise that's included in there. The eligibility reforms are largely the business of having people who you would believe it not should not be eligible to not be eligible, but that is certainly one of them. There are, even in the pay for only medically necessary and prior authorizations, that applies to Minnesota Care as well as other, but I think those are healthy reforms to be made. Let's see. At least in wandering down through the additional savings areas, those would be the ones that would affect Minnesota Care.
Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, then that's another almost $2 million, so that looks like it's $10, $12 million worth of cuts. Is there more than that $12 million worth of cuts to Minnesota Care in here?
That's a good one. Not that I can differentiate, because the other proposals are sort of general reforms, and I can't attribute those here just specifically to Minnesota Care. So, so the ones, and you have to also keep in mind that's trying to be characterized as people who might lose eligibility, and that's not necessarily the case here. I mean, for example, the premiums, which have been advocated by many, many people, don't speak at all if people choose to pay the premium to anybody losing eligibility.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, then I see under the increase in Minnesota Care premiums, that also has some information about 150% poverty level or less, 10% increase in premiums, so that you're booking a savings of $1.7 million to that. Is that then added to the $12 million from the three other spots where there's Minnesota Care cuts or increases in premiums?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I'm not sure about your math and what connection you're trying to make. The two lines are there to show you the detail of how we're proposing to implement the premium increases. Today, below 150% of poverty, people pay what's called a minimum, the $4 a month. That $1 increase would make that $5 a month. So that's just a way to handle the premium increase. Above that level, you'll see in the language that it increases premiums 10%. Many would argue that this doesn't even come close to keeping up to the actual cost of the plan that we have. So this could easily be characterized as at least doing something to keep a little bit more cost sharing.
Well,
that's a good one.
Chair and Representative Bradley, I had a call this weekend from some people in my district, hardworking people that are on Minnesota Care. It's a couple with a child that has some disabilities, and we keep talking like the $25 a month premiums, but these folks make $35,000 a year between the two of them, and they pay $358 a month. So it's not $25 a month premiums. I don't know who pays that. They would have to be so low, but their monthly premium is $358 a month, which is they're happy with because it's less than what they'd have to pay which they couldn't afford any insurance before that. So I just think that, you know, we need probably a list of all the, what the premium rates are here for different income levels and start talking about it more realistically.
Mr. Chair? Representative Goodwin, I would really appreciate it if you could give us some more information about that couple and their situation, because I think that would be very helpful to some of us that are trying to maintain the integrity of the system. I mean specifics about income earned and eligibility and all the rest. It would be very helpful for me. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Goodwin.
Representative Emmers, that information should be available from the department because they just got Medicare last week and their income level was $35,000 and they're paying $358 a month. So you can ask the department the same thing. I can get you the premium list sheet from them and show you what they're paying and what their income is if that's what you want.
Mr. Chair.
All right, here we have 20 minutes left, and this was supposed to be about better understanding the proposal in front of us. I have a few people on the list, so let's try to get to some clarifying questions here. Representative
Chair, yes, back to the clarifying. I don't know where the $25 came from. I never used that number. I used $4 going to $5, so I'm not sure where that came from. I'm hoping that you just understand. I don't say that you have to agree, and I'm looking forward on Thursday to your alternative ideas. So you have every right to create an amendment. If you don't particularly like this, show me what you would do instead and how you would pay for it.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, this is completely technical. The item we're talking about, the 175% of federal poverty level, that $2,191,000, that's in the health care access fund, those savings.
Representative Huntley, I think the answer is yes. We've pretty well built in sort of the movement of transactions. I think it's fair to say that in the government proposal, the health care access fund interaction, because we are moving people from Minnesota Care to MA, we're moving GAMC into that, it really becomes very blended. So I think we'll be thinking from a blended point of view. But to be exact, honestly, yes, that would be health care access fund.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bradley, I know that you and I were both concerned about it, but it's a policy question. In the family planning grants, we were concerned about making sure that WIC and some of those other programs were kept intact, and I never had anybody contact me, and I don't know if anybody contacted you to make sure the language allowed those dollars to continue to be used in counties.
Mr. Chair, and I'm assuming you may be talking about
the
Family Plan Grants Limited, the House File 227.
Right.
Maybe somebody else can tell me from staff. As I recall, there were classifications, and I hope that we got those taken out because there were some areas that were restricted. So maybe staff can update us on what happened.
Thank
Good
you.
Question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, I believe we struck the maternal and child family grant from the definition of what a family planning grant was, so they should no longer be affected.
I was also concerned about the county block grants, and that's typically where the WIC would come in, would be into the county block grants.
Ms. Taylor?
I don't have my statutes in front of me right now, but I believe that the WIC program was funded out of the maternal and child.
Maybe somebody from the department, Mr. Chair, because my understanding is some money comes out of the grants, but some money comes into county grants, too. Block grants.
All right.
So somebody from the health department to speak to that.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wolverton. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Carol Wolverton, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Health. And Representative Otremba, or Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, if I heard right, correct me if I didn't, that your question is what's contained in the family planning grant?
No, actually, Mr. Chair,
Representative Otremba.
When we visited about the block grants,
mm-hmm.
the county block grants, and the maternal health grants, it was my understanding that WIC, of course, comes sometimes through to the counties in the county block grants. In addition to, they come through as the maternal health grants, and I was just wondering if that got fixed in the language.
Ms. Wolverton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, the WIC dollars are not affected with the Family Planning Special Project grants or in that block grant. We have the MCH block grant, and those WIC dollars are separate from that piece.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I also was told by someone in the department that there are cases where the county block grants actually have the WIC dollars put in, not necessarily into that block grant, and that was the piece that I was very concerned about. We discussed it, like, in my office.
Ms. Wolverton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, the MCH block grant are federal dollars, as are the WIC dollars are also federal dollars. They are two separate pots of money. Now, occasionally, what one county will use their MCH block grants for may vary, but they're two separate pots of money right now.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that's exactly true, because I know that sometimes those WIC dollars come in a county block grant, and therefore, if there were family planning grants in that block grant, there's a possibility that that WIC piece would be affected.
Ms. Wolverton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, I will go back and follow up on that, and I'll provide you with a printout of how that comes so that you have it in front of you.
Because, Mr. Chair, we actually had that discussion in my office mm-hmm. with the other person from the department, and she's the one that said, no, actually, there can be WIC dollars in those county block grants, and that's what I'm not sure got resolved.
Okay, and I'll have her check that out for you.
Representative Huntley, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Wolverton, on the family planning grants with the waiver, do we have the waiver now, and what happens to those grants the way the bill is written if we don't get the waiver?
Ms. Wolverton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, we do have the waiver. We acquired the waiver some time ago, and it is due to be fully implemented. My understanding is the current date right now is in July of 06 that it will be fully implemented. And that's through DHS has the waiver.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to conclude this section, just to acknowledge it, I think we all know when we pass the targets that the House targets included an additional $50 million. So to keep this balance, that just is a line item to show that on here. And then to move forward, if you recall, in passing the targets, we had Plan A, Plan B. Plan B is in the lower part of the page. This is dependent on passing of another bill. We'll have essentially contingency language in it, but just to show you what the proposal would do should that happen. We would essentially buy back that eligibility. In other words, bring it back to the 190%. That's one thing we would do. That's kind of why I shaded the left hand there, just to kind of show you the candidates for buyback with that Plan B. The second thing we would buy back would be the outreach for addressing disparities. The third item that we would buy back would be the GAMC spend down. In other words, it would return to the 75%. And then the remaining funds we would apply to the extent available, and that's about $3 million in the next biennium, would be to do a little bit more of an increase in the home care reimbursement rates. I think I told you that the original proposal that this committee seemed to support would have made a pretty significant increase. I have in the bill currently 5%, and this would grow it by a little bit more. Still not even close, probably at best maybe 30-40% or something like that. So, Mr. Chair, that is a review of the actions. The only thing, I did try to go through very carefully, and I think the way that we presented it pretty much informs the committee those items that are policy that are included, because even some cases where we had zero. But I'm going to just sort of quickly list to the members some additional areas that may or may not be kind of tied to this, just to remind us. We do have an item in the bill on critical access hospitals. We do have language in the bill, which is the negotiated settlement on the consumer directive language. There, you may have been aware that the advocates in the department were having difficulty. And that's on page 30 of the summary, but there is now a negotiated language that takes care of that. We do have an item that allows rural pharmacy to have a carve-out opportunity on loan forgiveness. The governor's policy, health policy bills in here, so that included things, for example, like the trauma system, those kinds of things. I'm not going to re-review that. I think that was Representative Powell's, and we did have previous testimony on that. There is an item in here that would prohibit AIDS prevention grant information, funding to go to any organization that exhibits sexually explicit information. There is also a dental director study. There's electronic medical records, which I think allows a carve-out for rural implementation from current things. And then there's, I don't think it showed up on our spreadsheet, but there's a study asking the department to look at the implementation effectiveness of deeming a sponsored income for immigrants. And I believe, Mr. Chair and Elements, that's a pretty complete inventory of what is in the Delete All Amendments. So with that, I believe that concludes the review, and if there's any further questions for clarification, I'd be happy to respond.
All right, any last clarifying questions? Representative Huntley.
This may be for Ms. Shell. The GANC spend on to 50%, it's listed as XXX over there, and that's shaded. Do those shadings mean that's healthcare access fund again?
Is that from
the governor's budget?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, the reason for the little shading on the left was I kind of wanted to give you a hint of those items that I proposed to buy back with the $20 million Plan B. That's all it means.
So that GANC spend down, granted we're moving GANC, or let me put it, you're moving GANC into healthcare access fund, but if we didn't do that, those dollars would come out of the general fund.
That's right.
Okay, Representative Goodwin.
I have a couple of questions. Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bradley, how much in federal dollars are we going to lose under this bill, under your bill?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that question. I didn't actually do that. I'm really focused on what the Minnesota taxpayers are spending. So you can go through and look. I don't know, to be honest with you. Minnesota Care, we don't get federal match. So it would be anything where we don't get federal match on GANC. I suspect it's probably very little because we don't. The only place that we get federal match is MA, except for a few waiver spots in Minnesota Care, and we don't do a whole lot on MA.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. We get the hospitals get federal match for the state dollars. Is that almost a 1-to-1 match? From what I understand, so what would the loss in federal dollars be for the cut to the hospitals?
Representative Bradley.
You're right. Now I didn't show that because that was previously reviewed, and that is in the governor's budget. But the 5% rate reduction on programs where we're getting federal match would certainly we would not be getting that federal match. That's true.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, I have another question. On the list from the Department of Finance, we have about $77 million in contracts for the Department of Human Services, including the health match contract, which is going to be at least a year overdue and possibly more. How much, first of all, two questions to this. How much did you cut from state professional technical contracts in this bill, and how much did we add to the health match already funded program? And then I noticed in the governor's budget, too, a lot of additional funding for MMIS and MAXIS, which are two other contracts in the budget, and $22 million for the Department of Health for outside consultants. So did you make any specific cuts to that area?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, no.
No cuts. Okay, and Mr. Chair, I also wonder if you made any compliance issues surrounding the health match money for outside consultants, many of those jobs going overseas. And the other, there's two additional contracts in this Department of Human Services budget that have many jobs going overseas. Is there any language that asks for those jobs to come back to Minnesota, or any language that restricts the amount of time and additional money we're going to put into Health Match program?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, no, I don't have any additional language. I believe the department did testify to us, though, that moving forward, that there would not be any overseas contracts except for concluding what we have, but I don't remember for sure. But the answer to your question is no, I don't have any specific exclusionary language.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, the department sent to me the information about the three contracts that they have that have overseas jobs, and there wasn't any information in there that those, at least two of those three, that any jobs were going to be canceled that are overseas. I'm thinking as we're cutting all these people off of services, both in this committee and in the jobs committee, child care assistance and those types of things, that it's strange to me that we're still having people that lose their food stamps have to call another country to get those renewed when they are collecting food stamps because they don't have a job here in Minnesota, and yet we're funding to a great degree millions of dollars of funding for jobs in other countries, and yet we're, our people in our own state, we're not taking care of, and increasingly less taking care of their needs so that they can be full-time working participants and contribute tax dollars, but we're sending our tax dollars somewhere else instead. I think it's a real serious issue, and I brought it up last year too, and I don't see any corrections to that either this year or last year, and that's disappointing.
Representative Goodwin, do you have a bill number that you've introduced with these fixes?
Yes, I do, and it was not heard as what's happened before. It was not given a hearing, even with hearing requests.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I think we're in clarification. We're beginning to have discussion that goes beyond that.
All right.
We
have session at noon, so we'll have to wrap up here. Representative Bradley, do you want to go to the schedule for the week?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, it's our plan for tomorrow to hold public testimony in the morning and then to continue again after session as long as is necessary. The guideline that we've established is we are allowing 3 minutes per presentation, a little more, because there may be some with substance. We will then, on Thursday, the committee will take its action. We're asking that amendments be to our area by 4 o'clock tomorrow. On Thursday, we will meet at our regular time and then continue after session. Now, I'm hearing some things about, I don't know how long things are going to be. We'll probably just have to be flexible. And if we have to come in on Friday to conclude our word, we will do that. We'll take whatever time is necessary. But that's sort of the layout of our plan, Mr. Chair and members.
All right, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin asked about the cuts to hospitals, and if you look at the bigger spreadsheet, it's on page 5, and it's a $55 million cut for the biennium to hospitals, which most of which would be matched, so it's really a $100 million hit to hospitals. And if you then looked at the increase in uninsured this bill will cause, that will hit the hospitals even worse with uncompensated care. So there's a huge hit on hospitals in this bill. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Bradley, have you given any guidance to the testimony, what people are allowed to say or not say tomorrow?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Motley, no. Just time. Just to be respectful of time, so people have a chance that want to testify, have a chance to testify.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've heard that they were told they could only talk in favor of the bill, or they, if they wish to increase the funding for whatever they're there to talk about, that they had to come up with someplace else to cut. That's
absolutely not true. I don't know where that came from. It's not true.
All right. We will meet back tomorrow, and this meeting is adjourned.